Case number 18-5064. Richard A. Figueroa Appellant versus Michael R. Mateo, Secretary of the U.S. Department of State. Ms. Franklin for the amicus curiae. Ms. Schaefer for the appellee.
Ms. Franklin, good morning.
May it please the court, Amelia Frankel on behalf of Richard Figueroa, I've asked to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The question of first impression before the court today is whether an employment discrimination litigation, an employer may displace a presumption of discrimination simply by pointing to a list of employment criteria, or whether the employer must, in fact, enumerate the reasons for an adverse employment action. In this case, rather than doing so, the department pointed Mr. Figueroa and this court to 8 pages of employment criteria, which do not frame the factual issue such that Mr. Figueroa would have a full and fair opportunity to demonstrate pretext. In like circumstances, both the 7th and 11th circuits have recently held that summary judgment for an employer is inappropriate. First, in Target versus EEOC, the 7th circuit found that the employer who used set criteria and graded candidates using sort of a set rubric over set questions could not survive summary judgment when, by simply explaining that a candidate was not best qualified based on their interview. And the reason they said that was because there was no way to gauge whether those criteria were applied to the candidate. There was no explanation given by the employer which criteria he was found lacking, and none of the notes, as in this case, were produced. Likewise, the 11th Circuit in Voody said that it was insufficient for an employer to provide a list of criteria where it was not set out which of those criteria were decisive or how they were applied. Again, the issue is that the employee is at an information deficiency. Without that information, they cannot elaborate on where the pretext came in, whether those criteria were applied, or whether there was in fact discrimination in the hiring process. And that's the issue here. And because the department did not set forth that legitimate non-discriminatory reason with sufficient clarity, Mr. Figueroa does not have that opportunity. Another way to look at this is that the explanation that Mr. Figueroa was ranked.
He did have the opportunity, didn't he, when he was told you were not as well qualified as the ones we did promote, to seek discovery on those that were promoted in order to show in rebutting pretext that he was significantly more qualified than those who were promoted. And he didn't take advantage of that, did he?
Well, it's correct, Your Honor, that Mr. Figueroa did have an opportunity to seek discovery, and like many pro se litigants, was at a disadvantage in that discovery process versus the department. But the real issue is, even if Mr. Figueroa had asked all of the right questions, and even if the department had actually responded to those questions with sufficient discovery, he would have no way of demonstrating pretext, because there is no way to show he is significantly more qualified on every single one of those 30 criteria. What is needed for Mr. Figueroa is for the department to elaborate where he fell short. And another way to look at that is the cases in this circuit, which set forth that a subjective reason is required to be supported by objective bases. So in this case, it's very possible to look at the explanation that Mr. Figueroa was not ranked highly enough as a subjective criteria. In fact, you have testimony from one of the board members saying that, you know, that was just understood as whether he was suitable for the position or not, which really you can't get more subjective than that. And so in order to support that with objective reasons, what we needed was, you know, where in these 8 pages of criteria did Mr. Figueroa fall short, such that he can go back to his evaluations and look at the evaluations of the other candidates and say, no, you know, on the leadership criteria, I receive excellent, you know, observations from my employers or whatnot, whatever it may be. But because he doesn't have that, there's no way for him to make that comparison.
What about the Carter case that's from our court cited by your friends on the other side? That was a case where the reason that was given was that the plaintiff interviewed poorly before the recommending committee, and that was held to be a sufficient non-discriminatory reason.
Your Honor, as I recall, none of the cases cited by the State Department had as an issue the question whether a legitimate non-discriminatory reason had been raised. That was not something that was actually decided in any of those cases. I would need to go back and look at Carter specifically, but as a general matter, that's not something that was decided, which is why this is an issue of first impression in this circuit. Moving on, if this court were to decide that the reason given by the government was sufficient, there is evidence of pretext, again, sufficient for Mr. Figueroa to survive summary judgment. The first of that would be the destruction of the notes. And this is something that was sort of not even passed upon by the district court, and I think it's a significant oversight, because the destruction of the notes, when coupled with sort of all of the evidence that the criteria were not in fact applied, and because that's the government's explanation, the fact that they were not applied should be significant evidence of pretext. That, coupled with the notes, shows that he really did face an issue here, and it's something that he should be able to take to a jury. In addition and on top of...
Did he ask for any sort of a spoliation remedy or inference?
He did, before the district court, correct.
And the district court just didn't rule on it at all?
Did not pass upon it, no. There was some question whether the notes themselves contained hearsay. Simply in light of that question, it seems like the district court just did not resolve the issue, or it fell by the wayside. This was a long and complicated case before the district court, and I think they did sort of a good job of trying to parse the issues, but this is one that just simply fell through the cracks.
Didn't he have access to his evaluation forms that the boards looked at?
So there's two types of evaluations forms. So the first evaluation forms are the evaluations of his supervisors.
Right.
Yes, he did have access to those. What he lacked and what is critical is the notes and evaluations of the board members themselves.
Well, I understand. I'm trying to take it a piece at a time.
Yep.
He knew what his evaluations were.
Yes, correct. Those
so
are in the record.
Saying it's not correct to say that he was unaware of any alleged deficiencies in his work, because he had that. That's what the boards were looking at.
Well, and what is surprising about that is all of his supervisors for the previous 6 years had recommended that he be promoted immediately, and he was not. So there's nothing in his evaluations that would tell him where he fell short. What he sees in those evaluations is every reason for him not to be promoted, for him to be promoted, which again raises the question why he was not. And that's what's lacking from the record and what could have been in those notes, and we think was in those notes, and there should be a negative inference that they were destroyed.
Now, the problem is you can have evaluations of good. It's like law school grading. You're on a curve. It's not just you alone. Everybody's not going to get promoted. The State Department is notorious for that. This is nothing new. I'm not saying it's lawful, but it's certainly nothing new. And so the question is, where are you on that curve? So your supervisors may say, you know, good, but there are other evaluations that look even better.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I may, it's also nothing new that the State Department has been charged with discrimination. That is something that they have a very long history with. And again, it goes back to sort of the need for this legitimate non-discriminatory explanation so that Mr. Figueroa can show, you know, why it is, you know, that he did not fall short, so that he has that opportunity to demonstrate that he was significantly more qualified on whatever particular criteria the State Department asserts he fell short on. And that's simply lacking here. He simply cannot do that.
Well, the criteria are not really in dispute, as I understand it. It's your contention is how the board members weighed it. The precepts are pretty clear as to what they're looking for. And you have individuals, like grading, you have individuals who understand what they ought to be grading people on, and they make assessments one against the other. And so if you had the notes, heaven knows what they would look like. If you had the notes, is he entitled to then fight over what the notes mean and whether the board member's assessment was accurate? Board members say, you know, not so bad in leadership, language, pretty good. Are we going to have a battle over that?
That would be evidence that he could use to support his case or that the department could use to support its case. And again, to go back to sort of the lack of the legitimate non-discriminatory reason, the Seventh Circuit in Target, one of the ways that they said the employer could have met its burden of asserting that reason was to produce the notes. If the notes said something like, he is deficient in leadership, then we would have a focus for the question of pretext. Right now, what this case is lacking...
The notes might say he's good in leadership, but the notes for the other 12 people might say they're really good in leadership. That's essentially what's happening on the curve. I mean, they're not going to promote every person who wants to be promoted or who's been recommended to be promoted, and I don't know the law requires them to. They don't have to promote everyone who is within the pool, at least I'm not aware that the law requires that, who's within, if there's no pretext or an unlawful motive, they don't have to promote every single person who is arguably qualified to be promoted. So it's kind of a curved system, right?
That's absolutely correct. And if the notes were what you say, then they would have been helpful to the department. So that raises the question, why were the notes destroyed? And again,
want notes for everybody else. You think you can get notes for all other candidates?
Well, in fact, the department now has changed its policy and retains notes for all candidates so that you don't have this issue in future litigation.
So an individual challenging failed promotion can get not only her notes but everybody else's notes?
Well, the department retains them. Whether or not the department would produce them, again, particularly with a pro se litigant.
I'm just trying to figure out where you're going with this argument, because I mean, I can see some interesting issues that would result if what you're saying is correct. Because if it's on a curve system, then you've got to know what else the person is looking at. It's not an absolute promotion system, and you're not claiming it should be. So if it's not an absolute system, that means you have to have the notes not only of the individual, which tell you a little bit, but hardly enough on a curved system. You have to have everyone's notes, and you have to assume that you can look at everyone's notes and assume he shouldn't have fallen on the curve here as opposed to here.
Well, that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And in this circuit where someone has to show that they are significantly more qualified in order to succeed on a qualifications-based defense, that would be very difficult, I think, to prove in many cases, unless there is, in the notes, clear evidence of pretext. And again, we don't know what was in those notes here. That's why the negative inference is important. But I think another thing to note is that the rule that we are asking for, that a department or an employer must set forth its reasons for the employment decision, is that that would actually focus the review of the relevant records. Now, if you were to, under this policy, if Mr. Figueroa's notes and all the notes of everyone else existed, if this were a case arising today, you would have to parse those for 30-plus criteria and try and make a view as to whether on all of those criteria how he fit in. There simply would never be a way for an employee to do that. So what it would incentivize is for employers like the State Department is to promulgate really sort of lengthy or vague guidelines that would make it impossible for any employee ever to demonstrate pretext. Whereas the rule would say, would force the department to focus in and look at his thing and say, you know, here are the notes, and, you know, it says he's okay on leadership, but he's not great on these other things. Simply producing the notes would be a way for the...
You're talking as if it's an absolute grading system, and it's not. He can be okay on leadership, but he's not as good as the 20 other people who were going to move forward.
But what I'm saying, Judge, is that...
It may never be as good. It may always be at the grade below because you can't get past where he is on the curve.
And that would be a question...
I'm not talking about this individual. I'm talking about a hypothetical.
I understand. And so that would be a question on review of the record in light of the particular rule. Again, if the notes had been produced, that would be one way for the department to show what the actual reasons were for the decision, right? So the department could either say it's a lack of leadership, or the department could say, here's the notes, look at them. These are the reasons, this is what the board members thought. We don't have either of those things. And the rule should require at least one of them.
And what you're essentially saying, it's not enough for them to have very clear precepts, very clear criteria that the board follows. We got to know how each one was used by each board member.
Well, no. It is not enough to have criteria. And the reason is, Judge, to take an extreme example, the State Department could have all of these criteria, and they could be on the books, and the board members could have sat down and looked at Mr. Figueroa's thing and said, well, he's Hispanic, so I don't think he's suitable. And that's it. What these criteria don't tell you is what the board members did. And what the board members did, what is alleged that they did, is discriminate against Mr. Figueroa. And we need a way to know whether that happened.
You really think you're going to find that in the notes? He's Hispanic. I mean, the State Department has been accused of many things, but they're not that stupid.
Isn't there something in the record, though, from a declaration or about his, he was either operating out of his cone or the recommendations came from out of his cone?
Yes.
I mean, that's at least a specific reason.
So the problem with that reason, Your Honor, is that is a post hoc reason that was essentially invented by the HR department. And what the case law says is an employer cannot come up with an after-the-fact reason. You need the reasons that were applied by the decision makers. So if...
Well, how do we know it's post hoc if we don't have any notes or... I mean...
Because it didn't come from the board members. It came from a disconnected HR representative.
Okay.
Yes.
And aren't they running away from that reason now because it's an invalid reason?
That's correct as well, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. All right. Mr. Schaefer.
May it please the Court. I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney Dan Schaefer for the State Department. Your Honors, in this case, State's explanation was sufficiently detailed to and reasonably specific to frame the dispute and point Mr. Figueroa to exactly the type of evidence he needed to prove pretext in his individual case, and he simply failed to do that. These precepts that are issued in this case are not something that State has just come up with voluntarily. These precepts are promulgated by the Secretary pursuant to a statutory mandate that's in the Foreign Service Act of 1980. It says that each year the State Department is required to assemble these selection boards to review and rank the individual officers for promotion in a given year. And it is, as Judge Edwards pointed out, it's a relative qualifications. It's not absolute. And so the standard that Amicus is asking the court to adopt here, which would be an entirely new standard for this court that has never been applied in a previous case in this circuit, or any other circuit for that matter, the standard that Mr. Figueroa and Amicus are asking the court to apply in this case would be impossible for State to satisfy in this case. It would have been impossible for State to satisfy in this case, and it'd be impossible for State to satisfy it in any future case in which an individual service member in the Foreign Service challenges a decision. And the reason for that is that there are hundreds and hundreds of candidates under review in a given salary class, like Mr. Figueroa's. For example, there are more than 400 eligible candidates that were eligible for promotion in that year in 2008. So the idea that months or even years later, the State Department could identify a specific deficiency that each and every one of those individual officers had in that year. I mean, that's
not,
impossible
they're
for
not
them to
meet. Asking, I mean, a ruling in appellant's favor wouldn't require you to have to figure it out post hoc. It would require you, when you make the decision, to document why you made the decision.
Well, we think that the evidence in this, in the record in this case, shows that that's not how the board operated, and that that level of specificity, particularly in these earlier rounds of the selection board's review where they're going through a great many number of applicants in a very short amount of time, that level of detail in the note-taking simply isn't feasible. I mean, as it's undisputed.
Well, it would be nice if we could just see the notes, right? I mean, isn't that all the more reason why the notes are important here?
Well, under the board's document retention policy at that time, the notes were destroyed at the time of the board's dismissal. And the only record...
Well, we don't care about what your policy was. I mean, if you're on notice that there's litigation pending and the notes still existed, you don't get to come in and say, well, our policy said we destroyed the notes.
Well, there's no, as we would say, admissible evidence in this case that the State Department was on notice of, a reasonable notice of litigation at the time the notes were destroyed. So the notes were destroyed at the time of the board's dismissal, which was prior to...
Well, when were the notes destroyed?
That's in the record. They were destroyed at the time of the board's dismissal. I don't have the specific date, but it's in our brief where we point to the fact that the boards were dismissed, or I think the word is basically dismissed, disbanded on a given day. That's when the selection board's recommendations and rankings went up to the director general, and the board convened with the director general. The director general accepted the board's findings and recommendations, and in the director general's memo, it says, I hereby dismiss the boards and accept their rankings and recommendations. And at that point in time is when the board's notes were destroyed. Nothing was kept from the board's deliberations except that final list of recommendations and rankings. And then it was, I think, 30 to 60 days later, somewhere in that time frame, that Mr. Figueroa initiated the EEO process.
How do you get to rankings?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How do you get to rankings from the board's consideration of whatever they're looking at?
Well, the selection board's rankings, the formal memo that went to the director general has for each of the various categories under consideration, has a numerical list of the candidates. And so you can see, beginning at number one down through however many were recommended in a given year, in a given salary class, how they were ranked. And
so how do they get to that ranking?
I'm
looking at 10 people, and I have the criteria, and am I putting a number with respect to each criterion for each person and totaling that number? What?
It's a two-step process, so I'm going to have to give a little bit more of an involved answer here. But in the first, there are two separate boards. There's a class-wide board that looks at all the candidates across the entire generalist class.
I'm trying to understand, yep, how are they ranking. How do I, as a board member, what do I do to participate in what is going to end up a ranking?
Yes, so the voting procedures are part of the precepts, and they lay this out. Mm-hmm. And in general, what they do is all of the boards, and there are multiple individual board members who are looking at the same group of candidates. Right. They all come up with their own ranking system, their own individual rankings. And then I think what they did in this year is they convened a phone call, a telephonic meeting where they read out their rankings, and then the chairperson of the board.
Ranking, is there a number associated with the ranking, or it's just... You're rank one and I'm rank two, but I'm not going to tell you what the difference between one and two is. How do you do this?
I'll have to go back and look at it myself, but I think what they did was they said, we think this candidate should be recommended for promotion, so that's promoted, or mid-ranked, or low-ranked.
Right.
And I think there was a numerical score that was given for a particular candidate, and then the chairperson averaged out those scores, and then you come up with a cumulative number that the class-wide board settled upon. And so it is in the voting procedures that are attached to the precepts, and so it's it is set out there in a great amount of more detail than I'm able to provide, Your Honor, here this morning. But
yeah, it seems to me, I mean, if that's what you're talking about, it seems to me State Department would easily have information that could be furnished those who challenged. That is, well, where was I on the ranking? And in what, with respect to which criterion am I falling short? Whether you disagree with it or not is a different matter. But So where did I fall short? How could they not have that to make a decision as to who's going to move forward?
Well, the director of the Office of Performance Evaluation, Claire Perangelo, testified, and she was the one witness that the State Department offered that really gave some in-depth testimony on how the precepts worked and how the decision criteria applied. And what she testified is that since the board members were going through so many applications in that initial stage, what she did and what she thought was standard practice is that the board member would just write a P for promote, an M for mid-rank, and an L for low rank. And so in that initial review stage, there wasn't enough time to be taking detailed notes and for the board members to be having really thorough deliberations about individual candidates. Now, when they got to that step of the review process where they discussed their scores and came up with a number, if there were really wide discrepancies between the scores, they had a discussion about that. But
when you say scores, does that mean a number was associated with each precept?
My recollection is that there was a number that's set out in the voting procedures that is then attached to a candidate that comes up with that ranking, yes. And I don't remember exactly how that number was calculated.
That is thrown away, too?
I'm sorry?
That is thrown away, too?
The only document that survived the board's deliberation is that final recommendation memorandum that went to the Director General. That's correct. And if I may...
I mean, I don't know why you started all this by saying it would be chaos. I don't know what would be chaotic about showing... Here's what our ranking was. Here's what the person's score was with respect to each criterion. And as against other candidates, that person did. I mean, I'm thinking about law school grading. That can certainly be done. I choose to justify my own law school grading, and students may or may not agree with how I assess their work, but if you looked at your evaluation as compared to someone else's evaluation, you would see the deficiency. Now, you might be angry with it, but nevertheless, there it is. What's the big deal?
The big deal is that we think in this case that the level of specificity that the board members that state proffered relating to the board members' deliberations and the specific decision criteria that was applied on the facts of this case, given the unique nature of the competitive promotion process that the State Department used in the Foreign Service, the high volume of candidates that were under consideration, other factors that...
Well, the volume doesn't get you anywhere because you're saying, you precede that by saying, we evaluate each one. The fact that you do it quickly is so what? You're evaluating each one. So the question is, why shouldn't someone know? How did I fare in the evaluation? It's on a curve system. Where did I land?
Because
your problem with me is I'm thinking about law school grading. I can be made to do that. All right, it's an awful process. All these grading systems on a curve are awful, but they can be explained to the extent, because you've got to come up with a grade. And so the question in this case, it may only be a question of a system that is really not satisfying as opposed to discriminatory. I understand that's a different question as to whether it's discriminatory, but it certainly can be explained. So you're not giving me any interesting argument when you say, oh, but there's so many people. So what? You're grading them. You're saying everyone is required to follow certain precepts, grade, move it to the next step, grade, and then indeed at the last step, there are numbers. And you can see where you fell in the numbers, and on the curve, you didn't make it. Why isn't that available? Other than the State Department has this weird history.
Well, it's not just that the State Department has a weird history, but what I'm saying is that the Secretary has come up with these precepts, and they've been presumably developed over a very long period of time, many years.
The question is how they're applied. It's not that the precepts are bad. I don't see anything facially wrong with the precepts. They look perfectly fine. The question is, how did I fare?
Right.
And if I say to a student, you know, your citations stink, and I'm giving you a really low... On that part of my assessment, you don't know how to cite cases, or you cited the wrong cases. There it is. It's a good precept, and I'm saying I applied it.
Because I think in that situation, if I'm the law school and I tell Your Honor the law student, here is the specific criteria that you were judged upon. You know, in this class, this is what your answers on the final exam needed to say. This is the level of detail we were looking for, you know, those types of things. And if we laid all that out for you and said, here's the criteria we were looking for, here's you, Your Honor, you received an A-minus, and here are the lists, here's where you wound up at the end of the process relative to everybody else. We think that that's sufficient to satisfy a burden of production in a case.
No, but and I then mean, that, typically that, then, a law professor will have a sample of, here's a good exam and here's your exam. You want to come in and talk about it, I'll tell you. You're not doing that.
Well, yes, but then that's getting into, I think, shifting into step three of the burden shifting framework, which is then incumbent upon the plaintiff to come back and say, yes, but...
How can the plaintiff come back? The plaintiff doesn't know where the plaintiff fell short.
Well, the plaintiff can make an argument of, I am significantly better than this person because here's my answer.
You're not telling the plaintiff where they fell short, so how can they come back and argue? At least the law student can say, well, I hear what you're saying, but that's not correct, and you're going to have a discussion. You're not saying that. You're just saying you fell short.
Yeah, to me, it's not a question of the employer's burden of production at this point. I think we've satisfied it. I think the issue that Your Honor is now getting into is whether the plaintiff can ultimately satisfy his or her ultimate burden of persuasion that, yes, I am, I can show pretext because, for one thing, I'm significantly better qualified than the folks that you selected instead of me. And so that's...
How are they going to do that if they don't have the information on the other evaluations?
Well, you can serve discovery requests for information about the relative qualifications of the other candidates. You can take the depositions of the board members and say...
So you're saying the failure of discovery is
yes.
The problem here. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really, that brings me to the next point that I want to make, which is that in this case, you know, both in the complaint and throughout discovery and at summary judgment, the plaintiff's focus was really on, I perceived, and I litigated this case in the district court, was trying to find a way around satisfying his evidentiary burden in this particular case to prove pretext and discrimination. And what I mean by that is that the discovery requests and the allegations in the complaint, it's also reflected in the summary judgment papers, are largely focused on matters that were completely extraneous to this litigation. One of the things I would have expected a plaintiff to do in a case like this is to submit requests for discovery about the selectee's qualifications, and Mr. Figueroa didn't do that. I would have expected him to take depositions of some of the members of the selection board, and he didn't do that.
You can pick apart, you know, the fact that, you know, he, as an untrained person, didn't do discovery correctly. But ultimately, the problem I have with your position, I'm just going to be very direct with you, is that if we accept your view of the law, then the State Department could have a meeting of this board where the board members say, you know, with respect to Figueroa, who cares about what the criteria are? Let's just, you know, rank him low and ding him and not apply the criteria and move on. We don't like him. And that doesn't have to be documented. You don't get discovery of that. If it ever was documented, it could just have been destroyed. And he would be left with the only way that he could prevail as far as proving that the reason that was given, which was false, which was that we applied the criteria and he didn't meet up to the criteria, would be some sort of a disparate impact theory or showing that his qualifications were so much above everybody else's. Yes, those are ways that one can prevail as a plaintiff, but they aren't the only ways. And why shouldn't he have at least a fighting chance at proving just the straight-up falsity of the reason that was given?
Well, two things, Your Honor. I will say that in this case, we think that the plaintiff, notwithstanding that he was a pro se litigant, had, as you say, a fighting chance to make out a claim of disparate treatment and to make out a claim of disparate impact, and he failed to do that. But I would also add, Your Honor, that when looking at the state's promotion process that's at issue here, there are a number of safeguards that are built in to the promotion process. A few of those, off the top of my head, are that the candidates are all reviewed by two separate boards. There's the class board, and then there's the COMA board. So an individual candidate is receiving two independent reviews. The selection board members don't receive information about the candidates' races and national origin and other protected characters. That's not in the information that's provided to them. The selection board members, and these are high-ranking folks in the State Department. These are ambassadors and directors of bureaus, very high-ranking diplomats, if you will. They receive training on the precepts and EEO training, and these folks, as I say, are having to look through a very high volume of applications in a short amount of time, and with the information that they're provided, the idea that they're going to be looking into drawing inferences from the fact that somebody speaks a foreign language, for example, which presumably a lot of people in the Foreign Service can speak foreign languages who aren't native speakers, for example, or trying to draw an inference from somebody's name, that's just not plausible. That in the limited amount of time that all these folks have to go through this huge body of applications to rank, view and rank these folks, that they're going to be going through trying to find reasons to discriminate. It's on this record, there's no evidence of any kind to suggest that that's what the board members were trying to do or that they, in fact,
well, your did answer do. To Judge Wilkins then should have been, you don't like them, it's not prescribed discrimination. So they may have deemed them because they didn't like them, but it's not prohibited by the law. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. I mean, I think that we can all find aspects of this promotion process that we may individually disagree with to say that's not the perfect way to do it or there should be more detail. But as I said, this is pursuant to a statutory mandate, and these are precepts that are promulgated by the secretary. They're applied by the boards every year. And we think that the explanation that was provided was sufficient, that Mr. Figueroa had a full and fair opportunity in discovery to make out his claims, and he failed to do that. And the district court's decision is well-reasoned and thorough, and for all those reasons should be affirmed.
If they have a legitimate argument on the negative exfoliation, what do you think the result should be from that?
I'm glad Your Honor raised that. And I just wanted to address one thing really quickly, that counsel for amicus indicated during argument that the judge never reached that issue, and that's not correct. There's several pages in the district court's opinion that discuss Mr. Figueroa's request for a negative spoliation inference. And so the issue that the district court was deciding is whether there was a spoliation inference that could be drawn and whether that was sufficient to survive summary judgment. We weren't at the point in the case yet where Mr. Figueroa would have asked for a specific spoliation sanction or for a jury instruction, like you might see in some of these cases talking about spoliation. But so in this case, the question was just simply whether any negative inference of spoliation was sufficient to survive summary judgment. And the district court found, number one, actually the district court kind of found three things. Number one, that Mr. Figueroa failed to show that any information that would have existed in those documents would have been relevant to his individual claim, let alone helpful to it. And he pointed to testimony from the State Department that discussed, as I mentioned earlier, that the board members were reviewing high volume of applications. Number two, the district court found that Mr. Figueroa pointed to no evidence that he was entitled to a negative spoliation inference. And number three, that even if he was, that evidence alone wouldn't have been sufficient to survive summary judgment. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit there, but there were three separate findings in the district court's decision.
The second one didn't make sense. You must have forgotten it. I didn't understand.
The second one was that he was not entitled to a negative spoliation inference in this case.
Why?
Because he basically found that the court found that he didn't point to any evidence that he was entitled to a negative spoliation inference.
You're saying you don't remember. I'll go back and look.
No, that's what the district
court... Yeah, I mean, you can't just say, well, I don't think you're entitled to something, and so you lose. You explain why isn't he entitled.
Yeah, so...
I just don't remember, and obviously you don't either. It's okay. We'll look it up.
Okay. It's in there. My point was that it is in there. It's part of the district court's decision.
All right.
But we think that the district court's reasoning on the spoliation issue was sound and should be affirmed. There was some discussion during Amicus's argument about the statement that the two HR individuals made. I'm happy to address that further, but I do know I'm well beyond my time. So.
All right. I just have two questions. One. This forced retirement, is it tied to the age of the employee as well? I mean, I think he went 10 years without being promoted, but if he were a young person, is he still forced to retire? I mean, I don't know how old he is, but...
I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, that leads me to my second question, and I will ask it like this. Does the U.S. Attorney's Office here in D.C. as a matter of course, represent the State Department?
In this case, you mean?
Well, I know it's in this case. I'm surprised by that, and I just wondered if that is a change.
I have a number of cases, both employment discrimination and otherwise, where I represent the State Department.
Okay.
I think that's typical.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Is there anything further? We think the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
All right. Does Ms. Frankel have any time? All right, why don't you take a couple minutes?
Thank you. Your Honors, just a couple of quick points of clarification for the assistance of the court. The class procedures are set forth on JA 165 and the CONAL procedures on 238, and those set forth sort of how the different boards ranked candidates or whatnot. One thing that I think is worth noting and is important to note is that procedures for both of the boards set out that members were to take good notes. They were intended to do that. That is what the procedures said. So if they followed the procedures, they would have done so. There's also testimony from the board members that notes were in fact taken. Clarification regarding the district court opinion. There was discussion of the negative spoliation inference, but what was overlooked was in particular the observation of the EEO officer as documented in its report that Mr. Taylor pulled the PAR for Mr. Figueroa and reviewed the board notes that were on that. And again, there's reason to believe that there were in fact board notes on that. The testimony from the board members is that notes were taken on the PAR card. So if you were going to have notes, that is where you would expect them to be.
The district court found there was a lack of notice of any reasonable likelihood of litigation. That was the second point that counsel couldn't remember.
Well, correct. So the lack of notice of litigation was at the point at which the boards concluded and the notes were supposed to have been destroyed by policy. The evidence that the notes were not destroyed is by that point in time.
That was contested.
But not decided. It was overlooked by the district court. That's what was missing.
Whether they were actually destroyed.
Whether they were actually destroyed, correct. The district court.
That certainly was not a conceded point.
No, it was. But if you look at the district court's opinion at 21-22, it's not in there. It has just sort of that piece of evidence has fallen by the wayside.
So you would say that's a disputed issue of fact?
I would say that is a disputed issue of fact, yes. Just to go back to, I think, the overarching most important point that I want to make here today is, you know, the problem for Mr. Figueroa is that he cannot tell where he fell short. The entire point of the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting is to acknowledge that there is an information asymmetry between an employer and an employee. In order to cure that asymmetry, they set out this burden for the employer. The employer has to set forth their legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for an employment decision. Reasons, not criteria. Again, because we want to know how a decision was actually made in a particular case, not how it should have been made or is made in other cases or whatnot, but how it was made in a particular case. And it is absolutely false, as counsel for the department said, that no other circuit has held that that's required. In fact, every other circuit that has looked at the issue has said employment criteria are not sufficient. The Seventh Circuit in Target versus EEOC, the 11th Circuit in Voodie versus the Broward County Sheriff's Department, a very similar opinion, although not directly on point, from the 5th Circuit, Alvarado versus the Texas Rangers. All of these opinions are saying that you need reasons, not criteria. And so to hold the same, to impose the same rule in this circuit would be very much in keeping with what other circuits have done, and also in keeping with precedent from this court that says a subjective reason here, as one board member, you know, sort of summarized the criteria, whether a candidate is suitable, it is not sufficient without further explanation. And the further explanation would be either on what criteria did he fall short or produce the board notes.
Now, in the notes, the district court found that you, client, failed to provide sufficient evidence for the court to conclude that there were even any substantive notes to begin with. Without that, it's hard for the court to conclude, et cetera.
And so,
in other words, the district court said the burden's on you. You didn't meet it.
Well, again, there in the record, there's a couple of things in the record that are important. One, the policies that notes were to be produced, and two, the statements of the board members that notes actually were in fact created, including.
No, but they contested that. They said the notes were destroyed, and that the statement to suggest otherwise was wrong. And then the district court found you didn't show that there were any notes even to begin with, meaning. With respect to your claim that these notes may still have been around?
Well, with due respect.
Is it your burden?
It is a preponderance of the evidence standard for this spoliation inference. And with due respect to the district court, the only evidence that there were not notes is this statement of Pierangelo, who was not a board member. And so her statement, in my view, is not even relevant. What is relevant is the statements of the board members that, yes, there were notes. They were created. They existed.
No, that's not the question. The question is whether they were destroyed.
Well, there's two questions. One, as you just said, the district court found there was no evidence that they existed. And then two, were they destroyed? And I think that there is evidence for both questions for Mr. Figueroa.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. You were appointed by the court to act as amicus, and we thank you for your very able assistance.
Thank you.
Stamps.